You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In this country, we tend to take access to clean water for granted, and discussions of water contamination usually focus on other places. But the effects of climate change and population growth threaten the future of the availability of clean drinking water here as well. In his latest book, The Ripple Effect, The Fate of Fresh Water in the 21st Century, Alex Prudhomme questions the water protection initiatives in place in the United States and explains how widespread negligence and corruption pose serious threats to the future of our clean water supply. The book is published by Scribner. I'm very pleased to welcome Alex Prudhomme back to our show. Hello.
Hi there.
Now, you were here a few years ago to talk about My Life in France, which you wrote with your great-aunt Julia Child. That's a far cry from the concerns of this book, isn't it?
It is, although there's strangely a connection. Julia was one of the people who got me interested in this subject in the first place. I mean, I'm the kind of guy that's always been interested in water. I love to swim and sail and fish and just stare at the water. So I was predisposed to write about water. But there was one day when Julia and I were working on her memoir, My Life in France, and sitting in Santa Barbara in her little apartment. And we stopped for lunch, and she brought out a bottle of French mineral water. And we started talking about bottled water as a cultural phenomenon. And she noted how the French view mineral water as a health aid and a digestive. And they buy particular waters for the minerals that are in them. Whereas Americans buy bottled water as a healthier alternative to soda. And we like our water stripped of all minerals and all tastes. And so I thought that was an interesting idea for an article. And then that night we had dinner with her niece's husband, who is a hydrologist, who I think of as an Indiana Jones of water. He goes around the world doing all sorts of fascinating projects. And we continued the conversation. He started telling me that water is an access resource, meaning that water underlies all other resources. So whether you are growing crops, or you're building computer chips, or you're mining for gold, all of these resources require great amounts of water. And he was saying that this century, these resources are going to come in conflict with each other. They're going to be resource wars because there's a limited amount of water and a growing need for goods.
As we're seeing right now in Chile, where there's a big fight over whether to build dams in Patagonia and destroy the environment in some people's minds, but also allow for more mining, which requires all that water.
And in that case, and in the Western U.S., that's largely driven by demand for power. Some of those dams are going to be used for hydropower. And this is a big concern in decades to come because people may not realize this, but electricity requires huge amounts of water, whether you're talking about nuclear power, ethanol, solar, gas-powered, coal, whatever. All of these things require water for getting their fuels, for running their industrial works, and for dealing with their pollution. And so the extraction of water from the environment and the emission of pollution has a huge impact on the ecosystem and ultimately on us.
In the 1970s, the United States passed the Clean Water and Safe Drinking Water Acts. President Nixon signed those?
That's right, yeah.
Are those measures working?
Well, those were partly sparked by the burning of the Cuyahoga River in 1969, which became so toxic that the pollutants literally ignited.
That's in Cleveland.
That's right, near Cleveland, yeah. And the poisoning in Love Canal and these sort of water-related pollution problems. And at the time, there were no real comprehensive laws and regulations, and this was a very important thing for the country. And we cleaned up our water a great deal. And then we kind of forgot about it, and we moved on to other things. And it's almost 40 years later now, and one of the things I was shocked to discover in researching this book is that here we are 40 years after the Clean Water Act and the founding of the EPA, and in fact, our water quality is getting worse, not better.
Hasn't the Environmental Protection Agency been under attack in this current Congress?
Indeed.
Some are calling for its elimination. What's the argument for doing that?
Well, if you talk to someone like Michelle Bachmann or Newt Gingrich or indeed members of Congress, they'll tell you that the the EPA should stand for the job-killing agency. they believe that too much regulation is stifling the economy. What that argument misses is that the pollution of water supplies and the misuse of water supplies impacts all of us and will, it may benefit a few people in the short term, but in long term, destroying water supplies it's insane.
But what is the public response? What do polls tell us?
Well, very mixed, very mixed. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. People are confused. I think if you tell them that their water will be polluted by a giant, nuclear plant is sucking in lots of water and using it for its cooling towers and emitting hot water, which kills the fish, when they understand that their water is being impacted, then they get upset. In the kind of abstract, though, people tend to say, well, yes, we need more jobs. And this is one of the core issues in the debate over hydrofracking, for example, that people want jobs, they want income, and I sympathize with that. But if it comes at the expense of water quality that, we all rely on, then that doesn't make any sense at all.
Was the EPA more effective in its early years? Was it undercut to some degree by the Bush administration, for example? Didn't Christine Todd Whitman eventually resign from the EPA?
Yes,
because
she did, yeah.
Even she felt that that it was losing too much of its power.
Yeah, I think early in its incarnation, there was a guy named William Ruckelshaus who was the first administrator of the EPA, and he made a very shrewd move, which was to make an example of a few polluting companies in a few important states, and he named them and he went after them, and that really had a big impact. And then over the years, the EPA has been politicized and has been underfunded and under both Democrats and Republicans, but really under George Bush kind of browbeat the agency. And I think that from what I've heard from people, the morale at the EPA was terrible. Obama came in and he gave the EPA its largest budget yet. And the current administrator, Lisa Jackson, has been trying hard to change the way things are done there. For example, vis-a-vis the Clean Water Act, she recently issued a statement, some suggestions about how the Clean Water Act could be better enforced. But they're just suggestions, and there's no sort of regulatory muscle there. And this is the problem, that industry lobbyists are so strong in Washington, and with the recession, there's such a demand for jobs that it's very difficult to make that argument that clean water is more important than jobs. And it's really a question of educating people and getting them to think about the importance of a clean environment.
My guest is Alex Prudhomme, whose latest book is The Ripple Effect, The Fate of Freshwater in the 21st Century. Well, is it a matter of these two acts, Clean Water and Safe Drinking Water Acts, being out of date, or because new pollutants have come along, or is it simply a matter of them being under-enforced?
All of the above. Some of the laws we have on the books are quite good, but the regulators have been cowed and are not enforcing them as they should. In other cases, the laws and regulations have not kept pace with the pollutants. I mean, I was astonished to find out that there are 700 new chemicals that come on the market every year, most of which are never tested for toxicity. So we don't really know what their impact is on fish and insects and on aquatic plants and indeed on us. And I spent some time in places like the Chesapeake Bay, which is at the feet of Washington, D.C., and was horrified to discover that Chesapeake Bay, which is traditionally one of the richest fisheries in the world, is being decimated largely by agricultural runoff, which means fertilizers and pesticides that are used by the poultry industry. These things get washed off the land and into rivers and streams and are fed down into the bay, which is a very rich ecosystem. And when the sunlight and the water and all the rich stuff in that water is impacted by these things, the result is giant algae blooms, which create what are called dead zones. And these are algae blooms suck all the oxygen out of the water, block the sunlight, and essentially kill everything within range.
And you say that fish are indicator species.
That's right, meaning that fish are sort of the canary in the coal mine there. Fish are very sensitive, and when things are going wrong in the water, fish will let you know by their behavior. One of the things they're discovering in the Chesapeake Bay is the fish are developing these lesions along their side, which are these big, horrible-looking sores. They're dying. You may have seen photographs of big pods of dead fish floating in the bay or in the rivers leading to the bay. And the third sort of scariest thing is the incidence of what is called intersex. Intersex is essentially when male bass start to develop eggs in their testes. This is a fairly new discovery. It's believed that it's caused by a class of drugs known as endocrine disruptors. So, for example, if
you mean that have just been dumped into the water?
Well, if you use an herbicide which contains a chemical called atrazine, for example, to get rid of the dandelions from your lawn, it gets washed off the land and into the rivers and down into the bay, and it disrupts the endocrine system, which monitors the growth and development of the body. Now, why do we care about this? Well, it turns out that the endocrine system of fish is very similar to that of humans. So if we're negatively impacting the fish development, what are we doing to ourselves? We don't know the answer yet, but scientists are very concerned, and they're right now studying this problem.
And Chesapeake Bay used to be a great source of oysters as well. Has that gone into decline?
The oysters are being decimated, mostly by pollution, and oysters have been overfished. The famous Chesapeake Bay crabs have been particularly decimated. When I was down there with the U.S. Geological Survey, we took a boat trip across the bay to look at the dead zones, and that was fairly shocking to see. And then we had a lovely lunch at a restored inn that overlooks the bay, and we had crab cakes that were prepared by a chef who had specialized in this famous regional dish. And they were, I have to say, the best crab cakes I've ever had. They were fabulous. And at the end of our meal, the lead scientist said, "By the way, where did you get your crab from?" And he looked out at the bay and said, "Indonesia." And which to me was a sort of bitter irony. You know, here we are right on the bay, and he's getting his crab from Indonesia.
Well, there are dead zones in other places as well. A huge one in the Gulf of Mexico, isn't there? Is it the same sort of thing we're seeing in Chesapeake Bay?
Yes, yeah. Even bigger in the Gulf of Mexico. The one there in the Gulf is the size of the state of Connecticut. And, you know, combine that with the oil spill from the Deepwater Horizon, and you have a double whammy impact on the ecosystem, and it's you know, you're seeing the results.
And that's because nitrogen is getting into the water?
Yes, nitrogen and pesticides and who knows what other, you know, sort of growth hormones that are being fed to cattle all up and down the Mississippi River, things that are being fed into the crops. These are, you know, we know what's causing this. And essentially the only way to stop it is to reduce the use of these things that the agricultural and farming industries rely on. And that's a very difficult political sell.
My guest is Alex Proudhon, who has written for The New York Times, The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Talk and Time. And his books include My Life in France, which he wrote with his great aunt Julia Child, also The Cell Game and Forewarned, which he wrote with Michael Cherkassky. His latest is The Ripple Effect, The Fate of Freshwater in the 21st Century. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Stay with us for more. We're back with Alex Proudhon. His new book, The Ripple Effect, The Fate of Freshwater in the 21st Century, is published by Simon & Schuster. And you write about Newtown Creek in the book. Oh, we've done a series of shows on that situation, but would you like to fill in our listeners on what happened there?
Sure.
This is not a new thing. We can't blame this on any recent administration.
That's true. This is a classic case of what is known as legacy pollutants, that are pollutants that have been in the environment for a long time, kind of quietly sitting there festering away. I discovered this story because when I first started writing about water, it's such a vast subject that it was a little hard to know where to begin, and I decided to look into my own backyard. And I stumbled over some artist friends who were working around Newtown Creek, which is the little waterway that separates Brooklyn from Queens. And it's only about a mile and a half or 2 miles from my house. And I went down there, and I met a nun named Sister Frances who had been working in the community trying to alert people to the fact that there was a giant oil spill in the creek that had seeped underground also beneath Greenpoint, Brooklyn. And Greenpoint has fairly recently been rezoned from a light industrial to more residential area. And as places like Williamsburg become too expensive for the artists to live in, it's now becoming a booming residential place. But there have been people who lived there for years, and it's been an industrial area, and it's very kind of gritty. But it was named Greenpoint because it was a green point of land that stuck out into the East River, and it was a rich ecosystem until oil refineries were built along its banks, most notably by Standard Oil in the late 19th century. And they were not careful about how they disposed of their pollutants. Sometimes they would dump oil directly into the creek or onto the ground just to get rid of it. Sometimes there'd be overflows. And this happened for years and years. And the oil, which is full of toxins like benzene, which is a carcinogen, slowly built up and created what they call in the neighborhood black mayonnaise. It's a black viscous goop that coats the bottom of the creek, which is now essentially lifeless.
There was also an explosion in one of the tanks in the late 40s, I think. And nobody's ever really cleaned, or only recently have there been attempts to clean up, because everybody said, well, it's not my responsibility. There is no Standard Oil anymore. And that was all done by people who aren't even alive anymore.
That's right. And that's the classic pass the buck. I think the explosion took place in 1950. And what happened was that, like the Cuyahoga River, the toxins underground it literally ignited and blew up and blew some manhole covers off, shattered windows. Rather amazingly, no one was killed, but people were shocked by this. And an inspection was done, and they figured out what the problem was. Yes, there's a giant oil spill underground, and then nothing happened.
I've sailed, or whatever word you want it. I've been on a boat down the Newtown Creek. And it is still shocking to look at. There's oil on the surface, all sorts of other stuff. People test it regularly for toxicity, and it's highly toxic to this day. Can it ever be cleaned up?
Well, it was last fall just named a Superfund site, which was a huge victory. But that Superfund process takes a decade at least just to study it, and then it's a very slow process of removing all the toxins and filling them in with clean soils and so on. And so that will clean up the creek to a certain extent, but there are still industrial operations along its banks. I mean, I was just there not too long ago, and as I stood there, the giant oil slick floated by, and in the background, a big metal claw was pulling car parts out of a barge and dropping a few of them in the water. I mean, this was just a typical day. This kind of stuff happens all the time. The thing that I didn't see that particular day was when there's a huge rainstorm and the old city sewers can't handle the storm surge and raw sewage starts to pour into the creek.
Is that what's happened with the Gowanus Canal as
That's
well?
That's right, yeah. The Gowanus is also a similar
Lucky Brooklyn
case, exactly. And that, too, is going to be cleaned up. But, you know, these legacy pollutants are in there and they're very toxic. It took me a long time to get people in the neighborhood in Greenpoint to talk to me. They tend to be fairly insular. They don't want to cause any trouble. They're working class people. But I was able to finally meet some people who believe that they have suffered tremendous health impacts from the toxins. And I met a guy named Sebastian Perazzi, who has a very rare form of bone cancer, osteosarcoma, which, you know, hardly occurs at all. And there's a cluster of this particular kind of cancer in Greenpoint. And he and a number of other people are involved in a multi-billion dollar class action suit against ExxonMobil, which is the present day incarnation of Standard Oil, which has for years fought any kind of regulation or, you know, they've cleaned up a little bit, but not really. And when you speak with people like Riverkeeper, who did some great investigative work on this case, they discovered some documents that seemed to indicate that there was a cover-up of some kind between regulators and the oil companies involved. And, you know, I'm not qualified to say whether or not there was, but certainly looks as though people turned a blind eye. And the thing that I found shocking as a citizen was that here we are in the most densely populated city in the nation, in North America. And in the heart of our city was, until the Deepwater Horizon, the largest oil spill in the history of North America, and nobody knew about it. And it's toxic. And I just found that shocking. And so, you know, that was one of the things that got me to start writing this book. I started screaming from the rooftops. And I hope that that story in the book is compelling, and that it also acts as a stand-in for similar cases all across the country.
My guest is Alex Proudhon, whose latest book is The Ripple Effect, The Fate of Freshwater in the 21st Century. It's published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, you grew up on the Housatonic, didn't you? And from your account, it was pretty polluted. How did it compare to Newtown Creek?
Well, that's another interesting case, another one of those things where I looked in my backyard and was shocked to discover that the river I had grown up swimming and fishing and canoeing in, turns out that it's one of the most PCB-polluted rivers in the world.
More than the Hudson, even though we hear about the PCBs from GE up there?
We know about the Hudson, and the Hudson is now a giant Superfund site. The Housatonic was similarly polluted by GE. There was a big plant in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, which used to make electrical capacitors. The plant is now largely empty. It's a big shell up there, but its toxic legacy lingers. And there are a few signs along the river that say, don't eat the fish. And I was sort of aware of that as a kid, but I didn't understand how bad the pollution was. And this is a beautiful river. It's a gorgeous river. It goes from the Berkshire Mountains all the way down into Long Island Sound. And it's totally picturesque, and yet it's poisonous. And there are people who do eat the fish and the duck and the muskrat they catch. In fact, one of the first duck they caught, that the investigators caught, had something like 3,700 parts per million of PCBs in its body, and it was treated as flying hazardous waste, which was just shocking.
Well, I remember talking about Newtown Creek. There are crabs that live in the creek and oysters, and then they migrate down the East River, and people find them elsewhere and think, well, they must be safe because they're not in Newtown Creek.
Exactly. You know,
and I'd imagine the same thing happens with the Housatonic.
Yes, indeed.
What happened in Butte, Montana?
Well, Butte, Montana is an interesting case. One of the interesting things about the Housatonic is that the local people in Pittsfield, many of whom used to work for GE, have become an environmental movement, but a real kind of blue-collar environmental movement. These are just regular people who want a clean river that they can use. And their dream is to essentially turn lemons into lemonade. They want to take the pollution of their river and of their groundwater and try to turn that into a positive. And what they want to do is they want to create a center for the study and remediation of water pollutants, because this is a major problem all across the country and, in fact, around the world. I did a little research, and I discovered there are other little communities across the country that are thinking the same way, that water pollution is a fact of life now, and why not embrace that, because there's not much you can do to to reverse history. And Butte, Montana, there's a giant copper mine that was owned by Anaconda Copper. And there's a big pit called the Berkeley Pit, which is filled with very, very toxic water. It's so toxic that when flocks of geese or duck land on it, they've been known to die off in big quantities. It's a terrible kind of situation. But it turns out that that toxic water has become a laboratory for the study of remediation, which is the cleaning of pollution. And there's some local companies, local boosters there who are trying to attract investors to come. And they're, in fact, developing technologies that they're exporting around the world. And now it turns out that scientists are interested in the toxic water in the Berkeley Pit, because it turns out that there may be scientific and medical benefits. They've discovered there may be these little extremophiles, these little creatures that live in the water there, that may help to cure things like Huntington's disease and maybe even cancers. So it's a way of sort of finding the silver lining to a very dark cloud, and it gives us hope.
What's been the response of Mountain States Energy, which is was the polluter there?
Their response has been I'm not aware of a response from them, to tell you the truth.
They haven't been helping.
Not to my knowledge, no. It's been the local people, as in the case in Pittsfield, Mass.
Well, in any of these cases, has the polluter said, you know, we didn't know, we're sorry, and we're going to do everything possible to correct the situation?
I wish I could tell you that I'd heard that, but no, Leonard, I've not heard that.
You talk about Ettore Zuccato's research in Italy. What did he find?
Well, he's a terrific guy. He is a scientist, and he was doing an investigation of the River Po, which is a major river in Italy. And he thought he would find out what sort of pharmaceuticals are in the river. So he started doing a test, and he discovered that, number one, there was far more pharmaceuticals in the river than he even imagined. Number two, that there were some strange older pharmaceuticals that shouldn't have been there. And it turned out, after a little bit of investigative work, that the local farmers were feeding their pigs human chemicals, human pharmaceuticals, in order to help speed up their growth. And then he thought, well, cocaine is becoming a big problem in Italy. Let's take a look at the cocaine. And cocaine metabolizes in a very particular way. And so the only way for it to end up in the water is for it to be excreted by users. And so he did this test and discovered that there was something like 4 or 5 times the amount of cocaine in the river than they had suspected, which means that there was a much greater use of cocaine in the Po River Valley. And the sort of social and economic implications of that are huge.
Well, I would assume that we're also getting drugs from hospitals that are throwing them away, from people who are cleaning out their medicine cabinets. Where are they going?
Well, for years, we in the States were told that's what we should do. We should dispose of our pharmaceuticals down the toilet. Well, think about it. When you do that, guess where they go? A lot of these things are very robust. They're designed to survive the rigors of going through the body, and the body's a pretty tough place. And so some of these things survive the water treatment process, and they get into the water system, and they start having an effect. They lower fish's resistance to disease. They may be causing intersex.
Are they getting into bottled water?
Yes, that in some cases they've been found in bottled water. Not often, but in some cases. And let's not forget that a lot of bottled water is simply tap water that has been put through reverse osmosis. So things that are in the water system end up in everywhere. And the real question is, what is the cumulative effect of all this? What is the cocktail effect when you have, for example, synthetic estrogen, cocaine, Chanel No. 5, dishwasher detergent, and herbicides all mixing together in one body of water, and you have a tadpole or an insect or an immature bass swimming through that, what is the effect? We don't know, but it's not going to be good.
Well, your book title suggests there's a ripple effect.
Indeed.
What about climate change?
Well, climate change, despite what the naysayers will tell you, is a phenomenon that is indeed already affecting water supplies. As the air warms up, there's going to be more water in the air, more vapor. This has many consequences. One of them is that there will be more storms, and there will be more intense storms, so flooding becomes an issue. The quality of water gets degraded because the storms will cause more runoff. There'll be more silt and particulate matter in the water, which means it's more expensive for us to clean. And in cleaning it, then that adds greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. Climate change will make some regions hotter and drier.
Cause droughts,
terrible droughts. I mean, look at the Southwest right now. You have these record-breaking droughts. Wildfires everywhere, while there are record-breaking floods in the north. We're in a year of water now. Just to make a transition here, right now, if you look at the front page of the newspaper, we're having a remarkable hydrological year right now because you have these record-breaking rains and snowpack in the Midwest and Mountain West, these terrible floods that are causing evacuations in the Dakotas and in along the Mississippi. Places like Montana have so much snow that it's likely to keep flooding there well through the summer, maybe even into the fall. At the same time, you have in the South, you have record-breaking wildfire in Arizona right now, in Texas, worst drought in 45 years. So this is a year when we are being forced to confront water in a new way. And what the scientists are saying is this is the new normal.
Well, what happens when we drain the Great Basin aquifer and the aquifer under New Mexico and the Colorado River dries up? What happens to the Southwest?
Well, traditionally human communities were built around water supplies because they were necessary for survival. We've gotten so good at capturing water and transporting it that we have lately been able to build wherever we like. We build giant cities like Las Vegas or Phoenix or Los Angeles, for that matter, in the desert, a place we would never have built 100 years ago or more. We are building on steep mountainsides, which are subject to, massive mudslides. We are building in floodplains in places like Sacramento, places we know that flood, and we protect them with levees. But levees are, not a great answer. Climate change is going to impact all these places, this year's weather is forcing us to think about this, whether we like it or not. And it's likely that this weather is being caused by a La Nina effect, but this is an indicator of climate change.
Alex Prudhomme's book, The Ripple Effect: The Fate of Freshwater in the 21st Century, is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much.